The headlines. Iran says the removal of all sanctions, which is a prerequisite for the U.S. to return to the JCPOA, needs to be verified by Tehran. Newly released satellite images show that Israel, which is widely believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, is significantly expanding its Dimona nuke facility. And UN documents show that private military contractors, including infamous Blackwater, helped flow American weapons into Libya in 2019. Well, welcome to our studio here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Washington's return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningful only if it removes all sanctions against Tehran. Majid Taftar Avanchi said Iran's acceptance for restricting some of its nuclear activities was in response to the lifting of sanctions by the UN Security Council, Europe, and the U.S. He added that the removal of those sanctions must be verified, and a simple statement or signature would not be acceptable to Tehran. The Iranian envoy stressed that once his country finds the process of sanctions removal was properly executed, it would fulfill its obligations under the deal. Taftar Avanchi also referred to the necessity of compensating Iran for its financial losses, adding that the issue is, however, not a prerequisite for the U.S. to return to the JCPOA. U.S. President Joe Biden has taken new steps on Iran and the nuclear deal. Speaking at the Munich Security Conference, Biden signaled that the U.S. is willing to talk with Iran about the nuclear deal to be brokered by the EU. Iran does not find that enough. Tehran regards the steps that the U.S. has taken as a non-starter.
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has announced three symbolic gestures toward Iran in an apparent break with former President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Ned Price, a spokesman for the State Department, said Thursday the Biden administration was willing to meet with Iranian officials and other world powers involved in negotiating the nuclear deal. Price said Washington would accept an invitation from the European Union's top diplomat to attend a meeting aimed to discuss a diplomatic way forward on Iran's nuclear program.
Well, the U.S. is trying to play a little game here by saying, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to meet Iranians and I want to talk about the JCPOA, and maybe the U.S. will lift some sanctions. It's just the message the U.S. is just not getting it right. The U.S. needs to understand when Iran stops giving false hope that there is no return to the JCPOA unless the Americans lift all sanctions, apply the lifting of the sanctions, allow Iran to sell its oil and to make deal with other companies as stated in the JCPOA, and then Iran will stop withdrawing from the nuclear deal.
Washington says it has lifted travel restrictions on Iranian diplomats accredited to the United Nations, headquartered in New York, limitations that were imposed by Trump in 2019. Also, in a letter to the UN Security Council on behalf of Biden, acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Mills said the United States has withdrawn three letters from the Trump administration that claimed the U.S. had reimposed UN sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Mills said that sanctions measures terminated in Resolution 2231 endorsing the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with six world powers, remain terminated. This is why the overwhelming majority of the members in the 15-nation council had described Trump's bid to restore UN embargoes on Iran as illegal, arguing the U.S. was no longer a member of the JCPOA.
The U.S. has offered a couple of steps that it would take at this point to show what it considers as steps to bring Iran back to the negotiating table. It has eased strict travel restrictions on Iran's UN diplomats imposed by the former U.S. President Trump. It also refers to Trump's efforts to restore all U.N. sanctions on Iran. Iran's response? Well, Iran's leader has stated that the U.S. must lift all sanctions first. Then these U.S. moves fall short of Iran's request. Now, this means that Tehran considers Washington's moves to be a non-starter. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking on the IAEA inspections. Iran has said that it would limit snap inspections of its nuclear sites by February 21.
In a tweet, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, responded to the U.S. acknowledgement that the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA has not been triggered. He reiterated Iran's position that Washington must lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the Trump administration before Tehran reverses its scaleback of the commitments under the nuclear accord. Zarif had earlier urged France, Britain, and Germany, three European signatories to the nuclear agreement, to abandon their calls on Iran to act first to salvage the JCPOA and instead demand an end to the U.S. quote, economic terrorism on Tehran. In a reaction to the U.S. announcement that it would accept the EU's invitation to a meeting of Iran and the P5+1, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said P5+1 no longer exists due to Washington's withdrawal from the deal. He repeated Iranian officials' stance that the U.S. must first put its words into action before Tehran follows suit. Even after the U.S. exit from the JCPOA and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran remained fully committed to the accord for a year before gradually reducing its commitments in five steps, citing the failure of the European signatories to the deal to keep their end of the bargain.
Iran made it very clear the government is forced to abide by the decision of the parliament, and the parliament decided to implement several steps, one after the other. The first one is the 21st of February, and on the 21st of February, Iran will withdraw from the voluntary protocol and will reduce the sudden inspection of the atomic energy inspector. Therefore, the Americans need to understand that there are other steps that will follow if the sanctions are not lifted.
The country has times and again noted that all the retaliatory steps are reversible once all signatories honor their obligations.
Newly released satellite images reveal a significant construction work at Israel's Dimona nuclear site. An independent group of arms control and non-proliferation experts, known as the International Panel on Fissile Material, published the images on Thursday. The group's website says the construction has expanded in the Negev desert and appears to be actively underway. Israel is believed to be the only possessor of nukes in the West Asia and estimated to have between 200 and 400 atomic warheads in its arsenal. Israel neither admits nor denies having the nukes, but activists have warned time and again of the enormous threats posed by Israel's nuclear activities. Israel has so far defied international calls to join the non-proliferation treaty and never allowed any inspection of its nuclear facilities. Senior geopolitical analyst Alexander Azadgan says the international community is largely hypocritical in its approach toward Israel's nuclear program.
What was leaked to us by this Israeli nuclear whistleblower, Mordechai Vanunu, does estimate that Israel has and maintains at least 90 nuclear warheads that have been produced from plutonium. This is something very important because Iran is being accused of this. But to make the matters worse, as everyone knows, Israel is not, like you mentioned, a signatory of NPT, and neither does any of its facilities subject to the IAEA inspection. While all along, not just during the past 5 years, not since July of 2015 that the Iranian nuclear deal was signed, but going back to 12 years prior to that, the Iranian facilities have been inspected, minus four though, minus the military sites, but the rest of them were literally the most scrutinized nuclear program in human history. There is tremendous hypocrisy here and inconsistency.
UN documents show private military contractors, including infamous Blackwater, had helped flow American weapons into Libya for an assault on the UN-backed government there. UN experts have obtained documents in an 18-month investigation that shed new light on Washington's weapons proliferation regime. They indicate that private security firms attempted to bring Western military experts as well as equipment such as drones, speedboats, and assault weapons into Libya in 2019. That's in order to assist renegade General Khalifa Haftar, who was seeking to take control of the country with the backing of some Arab states, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Any transfer of U.S. weapons to a third party is a potential violation of UN arms embargoes, as well as America's own laws. But instances reported by the media and rights groups suggest American arms have often ended up in Libya in violation of the UN Charter. International lawyer Barry Grossman says the U.S. prefers to use limited liability corporate mercenary forces in order to wage its battles abroad.
The U.S. prefers to use corporate mercenary forces in order to wage its battles with a measure of plausible deniability built into it. So no, I certainly don't find it surprising. What I find surprising is that reports of this story seem to be distracting from the main issues by going so far as to focus on suggesting that former President Trump is responsible for all of this, when it's quite clear that the Libya project was initiated, was commenced by the Obama administration and executed on the United States' behalf by NATO in conjunction with France and the UK, with the support of Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, and others. What I also find surprising, since you asked me what I'm surprised by, is that there's really nobody talking about holding both Prince and Blackwater, or his various companies, responsible for their, among other things, violations of the UN arms embargo connected to Libya, but more generally for their war crimes, or for that matter, holding Khalifa Haftar responsible, who for many years was a CIA asset.
African Union mediator has visited Sudanese capital Khartoum for talks with the country's officials on border tensions between Sudan and Ethiopia. Mohamed Fazari has more from Khartoum.
The African Union mediator Mohamed Al-Hassan Labad visited Sudan's capital Khartoum to discuss regional issues, particularly the border tension between Sudan and Ethiopia. Earlier this week, Sudan summoned its ambassador from Ethiopia for consultation amid border tension between the two neighbors. Labad affirmed the African Union's keenness on principles of peaceful African solution to African issues and challenges, and its readiness to provide support for Sudan's transitional government.
The visit of AU envoy to Sudan is part of AU's effort to reduce tensions between the conflicting sides through diplomacy. I think the envoy is qualified enough to play a great role because of his previous experiences in mediation between the Sudanese civilian and military factions. That's why I think the visit will have due results.
Sudan and Ethiopia have been locked into dispute over water and agricultural lands in Al-Fashaga as well as refugees. Tensions have led to armed clashes between Sudanese and Ethiopian forces in recent months, with each side accusing the others of instigating the violence. The two countries held talks in January in Khartoum to de-escalate. Observers say the policy adopted by African Union during its last summit to reduce tension of border between Sudan and Ethiopia should be taken more seriously.
I think that African Union is capable to solve their own problems and conflict because African Union have always been capable and have a rich history of solving their own problems. Also, it's known that there are great minds and great brilliant minds that can solve these problems.
Earlier, Mohamed Al-Hassan Labat led negotiations between the internal Sudanese parties following overthrow of the regime of the former president of the country, Omar Hassan al-Bashir. Sudan is currently hosting more than 61,000 Ethiopian refugees in the east border of Sudan, states of Katala and Gadarif.
Observer here say the visit of the African Union's envoy reveals the importance that the body is attaching to resolve the tension in the region. Now the main question lingering in minds is how far the envoy will manage to accomplish his mission. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
Anti-coup demonstrations in Myanmar turned deadly as people continue to demand a return to civilian government. The Volunteer Emergency Service says two people were shot dead in Mandalay City as police used live ammunition to disperse protesters. About 30 demonstrators were also injured. The rallies came after the Friday killing of a young woman shot in the head by security forces. Hundreds of people have been arrested during more than 2 weeks of demonstrations. There's also been a growing civil disobedience campaign as people demand the release of civilian leaders, including Aung San Suu Kyi. The unrest started when the military seized power in a coup at the start of February, claiming the November elections were rigged. A report from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security shows right-wing extremists were responsible for the majority of terrorist attacks in the country in 2020. The The report is based on a review of last year's domestic terror incidents. This is the first time that the U.S. government has publicly acknowledged the rise of right-wing violence, despite being documented and investigated in the past. The report comes just weeks after supporters of former President Donald Trump, many of them members of extremist groups, attacked the U.S. Congress. Following the January 6th incidents, the new administration called for a review of domestic extremism, describing it as a serious and growing national security threat. Another independent report also indicates that white supremacists and other extremist groups had hatched the two-thirds of terror plots in the U.S. in the first 8 months of 2020. Millions of people in the U.S. state of Texas lack access to clean water after an unprecedented winter storm wreaked havoc across much of the country's southern and central parts this week. Texans were seen queuing up for hours on Friday to have safe drinking water and food. The disruption of water and food supplies comes amid record low temperatures that damaged the state's infrastructure and utilities. The deadly polar blast also caused widespread blackouts. The Texas governor says more than 160,000 people are still without electricity. President Joe Biden has planned to sign a major disaster declaration for the state. He also called on federal authorities to coordinate disaster relief in neighboring states of Louisiana and Oklahoma that were also hit by the extreme weather. At least 40 people have so far died by the winter storm across the U.S. Argentina's health minister has resigned over claims of improper COVID-19 vaccine allocation. Yunes Gonzalez Garcia stepped down after it emerged that some of his friends sidestepped proper procedure for vaccinations. The resignation was tendered on the request of President Alberto Fernandez on Friday. Gonzalez Garcia, a 75-year-old doctor, will be replaced by one of his deputy ministers, Carla Bizotti. Local media reported that other people close to the government were also vaccinated at the health ministry without following the procedure. This is while Argentina just started vaccinating the elderly on Wednesday after giving the jabs to healthcare workers. Argentina has recorded some 2 million COVID cases and more than 50,000 deaths. World leaders at the G7 summit have pledged millions of doses of the COVID-19 vaccine to poorer countries. However, this has been slammed as just another publicity stunt. The reality is that vaccine rollouts in the world's top economies are in overdrive, but it might take years for poorer nations to get their share. Campaigners say that they want hard facts on how many doses are to be delivered and when. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The researchers found that increased air pollution increased coronavirus transmission. A 14.3% increase in the air quality index, that is AQI, increases transmission 2.8 percentage points to 13 days after exposure to pollution. This result remained even after including lockdown periods and data from Wuhan, where the outbreak originated. They found that if the AQI increases by 10, the infection doubling time would decrease to 2.5 days after about 2.8 days. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written jointly by Lakshmi Supriya and Fiona Harvey titled, Air Pollution Increases SARS COVID-2 transmission. It kills 500,000 babies across the globe in 2019. Please stay with us to hear more about this issue. Evidence from China indicates that higher air pollution could lead to increased transmission of severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2, SARS-CoV-2, leading to more COVID-19 cases. The rapid spread of the SARS-CoV-2 virus across the globe has led to much effort to understand virus transmission. According to newsmedical.net, some factors identified include age, gender, and comorbidities. One factor that can affect virus transmission is air pollution. However, much less is known about how it can affect SARS-CoV-2 virus transmission. Air pollution can spread the virus by increasing infection susceptibility, impairing the immune system and making it difficult to resist infection. In addition, aerosols in the air can help the virus live longer and increase the chances of infection. Several recent studies have linked air pollution with the spread of SARS-CoV-2 virus. However, most of the studies use linear regression models to relate air pollution and COVID-19 cases and death. But virus transmission is exponential, and not taking this into account may give inaccurate estimates. For COVID-19, a second challenge is implementation prevention strategies, because lockdown, social distancing, and other interventions not only change transmission dynamics, but also air pollution levels. In a new study published on the reprint server MedRubix, researchers have estimated the effect of air pollution on the transmission of COVID-19 in China, which has very high levels of air pollution. The researchers from the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology chose the Susceptible Infectious Recovered Disease, that is SIRD model, widely used to describe the transmission of infectious diseases, and adapted it to account for exponential epidemic growth. Using the instrumental variable IV approach and thermal inversion, they separated air pollution from other confounding variables. Thermal inversion occurs when a layer of warm air lies on top of a layer of cooler air. The low-density warmer air traps pollutants, leading to increased pollution. Since thermal inversion is a complicated meteorological phenomenon that occurs randomly, the authors were able to remove the effects of interventions on the transmission. For the analysis, the researchers used COVID-19 accurate data and air quality data at a day-by-city level from January 1st to April 1st, 2020 in China. They found thermal inversion to be a strong predictor of pollutant particle concentration. Using the predicted air pollution, they modeled the virus transmission rate. The researchers found that increased air pollution increased virus transmission. A 14.3% increase in the air quality index, that is AQI, increases transmission 2.8 percentage points to 13 days after exposure to pollution. This result remained even after including lockdown periods and data from Wuhan, where the outbreak originated. They found that if the AQI increases by 10, the infection doubling time would decrease to 2.5 days from about 2.8 days. The authors also modeled the results for specific air pollutants like sulfur dioxide, NOx, carbon monoxide, PM2.5, PM10. They found the results were similar to those of combined air pollution model. A 10% increase in PM2.5, sulfur dioxide, and carbon monoxide increased the virus transmission rate by 1.4. 1.1 and 3 percentage points, and they found the results to be statistically significant. However, with an increase in ozone concentrations, researchers found a slight decrease in virus transmission, but the result was not statistically significant. This could be because ozone concentration often negatively correlate with other pollutants, or the ozone changes the virus structure. Furthermore, the researchers also estimated excess COVID-19 cases due to air pollution. For this, they hypothetically used an AQI of less than 100. In China, when the daily AQI is below 100, the city is considered to have good or moderate air quality. They found that the daily virus growth rate could have been reduced by about 2% if all the cities had maintained an AQI of 100. For example, the highest active number of infections recorded in China on February 14th was 21,855, which could have dropped to 16,714, a decrease of almost 25%, if the air quality was better. The total number of cases could have been reduced by almost one-fourth if there was reduced pollution. The authors noted a few limitations of the study. They used confirmed active cases in their model, which could be lower than the actual number of cases and may not be a true picture of the outbreak transmission. Furthermore, there is fewer data to correlate deaths from COVID-19 and air pollution, and the authors have not studied that. How pollution increases COVID-19 infection is particularly relevant for countries like India, Indonesia, and Pakistan that have higher pollution levels from coal, manufacturing, and other related economic activities. The wrote authors, policymakers should thus consider adopting more stringent pollution control policies in their war to combat COVID-19. Meanwhile, data shows air pollution last year caused the premature death of nearly 500,000 babies in their first month of life, with most of the infants being in the developing world. According to The Guardian, exposure to airborne pollutants is harmful also for babies in the womb. It can cause a premature birth or low birth weight. Both of these factors are associated with higher infant mortality. Nearly two-thirds of the 500,000 deaths of infants documented were associated with indoor air pollution, particularly arising from solid fuels such as charcoal, wood, animal dung for cooking. The discovery is reported in the State of Global Air 2020 report, which examined data on the deaths around the world alongside a growing body of research that links air pollution with health problems. Medical experts have warned for years of the impacts of dirty air on older people and those with health conditions, but are only beginning to understand the deadly toll on babies in the womb. Catherine Walker, principal scientist at the Health Effects Institute, which published the report, said, "We don't totally understand what the mechanisms are at this stage, but there is something going on that is causing reductions in baby growth and ultimately birth weight. There is an epidemiological link shown across multiple countries in multiple studies. Babies born with a low birth weight are more susceptible to childhood infections and pneumonia. The lungs of preterm babies can also not be fully developed." Dan Greenbaum, president of the Health Effects Institute in the U.S., said they're born into a high pollution environment and are more susceptible than children who went to term. Beat Ritz, professor of epidemiology at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, who was not involved with the study, said the indoor air pollution in cities across India, Southeast Asia, and Africa was comparable to that of Victorian London. Ritz said, "This is not the air pollution we see in modern cities in the rich world, but that which we had 150 years ago in London and other places where there were coal fires indoors." Indoor air pollution has not been at the forefront for policymakers, but it should be. She pointed out that the harm to children went beyond the deaths. Reducing air pollution would also lessen harm to survivors. She said there is also damage to the brain and other organs from this pollution, so just surviving is not enough. We need to reduce air pollution because of the impact on all these organs too. Some of these effects are likely to have existed unnoticed for centuries, as people have long cooked upon fires in enclosed spaces, an activity that causes particulate matter to be breathed in, particularly by women and children who spend more time in the home. However, the problem is now compounded by the population density of many developing cities and by outdoor air pollution from vehicles and industry. These factors mean there is now no escape from their year. From morning to night, for hundreds of millions of people, the report concentrates on data from 2019, so does not include the impacts of lockdown policies around the world in 2020. The author said the COVID-19 pandemic would have had an impact on air quality and death from air pollution, but these effects were not yet clear. Greenbaum said the likelihood of any long-term beneficial impact to health from the temporary reductions in air pollution because of lockdowns was small, but that the sudden clearing of pollution from traffic and industry had changed many people's perception of air quality. Greenbaum said people all of a sudden realized what it is like to have beautiful blue skies on a regular basis. Even if it did not last, it showed what was possible. Some studies have suggested that people exposed to air pollution could have a higher risk of death from COVID-19, but these are early findings. Greenbaum said more work was needed to establish what difference was made by exposure to air pollution. The scientist said there had been little sign of improvement in air pollution over the past 10 years, despite increased warnings over the risks from dirty air in the past 5 years. At least 6.7 million deaths globally in 2019 were from long-term exposure to air pollution, a factor raising the risk of a stroke, heart attack, diabetes, lung cancer, and other chronic lung diseases. Air pollution is now the fourth highest cause of death globally, just below smoking and poor diet.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a very important question, and that question is this. We know that we have been ordered in Islam to only worship God. How do we know this? In Surah Fatiha, we read the following. God says, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينُ. Thee alone do we worship, and thee alone do we beseech for help. So we've been ordered, we've been taught that we should only worship God. And we're not allowed to worship anything besides God. A lot of people take this to mean that we're not allowed to be humble before any being besides God. Even if we don't believe that that God, that person that we're humbling ourselves before, or that object that we're humbling ourselves before, is God. For example, if I humble myself before the Kaaba, before the house of God, I kiss it, or I touch it, I humble myself before it, I bow it before it. These people say this is an act of polytheism. You're worshipping something besides God, and God has prohibited you from doing so. Because in Arabic, the word ibadat means to be humble, right? Iyaka na'abud means, therefore it means thee alone do we humble. We only humble ourselves before you. Therefore, if somebody humbles himself before something besides God, he's disobeying this command. This assumption is wrong. And the answer to the question that we posed is that when God says and orders us to only worship Him and prohibits us from doing ibadat of a being besides Him, here the word ibadat shouldn't be taken in the lexical and literal sense of the term. Rather, there's a specific meaning here, a technical meaning here implied. First of all, we know that in the Holy Quran, God has allowed us to be humble before other beings, like our parents, or the other believers. Or, for example, He ordered the angels to prostrate to Adam, which is an act of humility. This in itself shows us that this the monotheism in worship doesn't mean that we're not allowed to be humble before other beings besides God. But there's another reason for this, and another proof which indicates the fact that here worship doesn't mean humility in the absolute and unconditional sense of the term. Rather, it means the act of humility, which is accompanied by a belief that the person or being that I'm humbling myself towards is my creator or my Lord. And that proof is this, that we see that in the Holy Quran, when God orders us to simply worship Him, only worship Him, before this, He always mentions these attributes and these names. For example, in Surah An'am, verse 102, God says this, ذَلَكُمُ اللَّهُ رَبُّكُمْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ خَالِقُ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ فَأَبُدُهُ. God says that is God, your Lord. There is no God besides Him. He is the creator of everything. So worship Him. So only worship Him. If here the word ibadat meant to simply be humble towards God, there would be no reason to mention these beautiful names of God and these attributes, right? Because in order to be humble before somebody, it's not necessary for that being to possess these qualities, right? If these qualities have been mentioned, it indicates the fact that the act of the ibadat that God is referring to here is an ibadat or an act of humility, where the person is of the belief that this person has these qualities within him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at monotheism in worship. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Geoengineering has been debated since the 1960s, when U.S. scientists suggested floating billions of white golf ball-like objects in the oceans to reflect sunlight. Interfering in natural processes was widely considered naive and dangerous until recently. But as the window to curb global warming shrinks, proposals to reflect sunlight, shade Earth's surface, accelerate carbon absorption in the oceans, and remove CO2 from the air are being taken more seriously. In October, Silver Lining, a non-profit organization, gave $3 million towards climate engineering research. Silver Lining's grant recipients are researching whether humans can blast sunlight-reflecting aerosol particles into the stratosphere, mimicking the cooling effect of volcanic ash clouds. In 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted, spewing sulfate particles into the atmosphere that caused global temperatures to drop 0.6 degrees Celsius over the next 2 years. Solar radiation management would involve sending fleets of aeroplanes up to 65,000 feet, where they'll spray sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere, or perhaps even diamond dust. A research team at Harvard University projects that if high-altitude tankers had the capacity to make 60,000 particle dumps by 2035, it would shave off 0.3 degrees Celsius off global warming. We now present you an article written by staff writers of The Week magazine under the heading, Should Scientists Artificially Cool the Planet to Stave Off Climate Catastrophe? Please stay with us for more. Should scientists artificially cool the planet to stave off climate catastrophe? Here's everything you need to know. What is geoengineering? Some climate scientists are coming to believe it's humanity's only hope for slowing down or stopping disastrous changes in the climate. A runaway carbon dioxide emissions contribute to melting ice caps, widespread flooding, prolonged heat waves and droughts, apocalyptic wildfires, and devastating hurricanes. Researchers are exploring planetary-scale interventions in Earth's natural systems as a way of counteracting climate change. Geoengineering has been debated since the 1960s when US scientists suggested floating billions of white, golf ball-like objects in the oceans to reflect sunlight. Interfering in natural processes was widely considered naive and dangerous until recently. But as the window to curb global warming shrinks, proposals to reflect sunlight, shade Earth's surface, accelerate carbon absorption in the oceans, and remove carbon dioxide from the air are being taken seriously. In October, Silver Lining, a non-profit organization, gave $3 million towards climate engineering research. Michael Gerard, a professor of environmental and climate law at Columbia University in New York, said, "I liken geoengineering to chemotherapy," he added. "If all else is failing, you try it." But what are the most plausible proposals? Silver Lining's grant recipients are researching whether humans can blast sunlight-reflecting aerosol particles into the stratosphere, mimicking the cooling effect of volcanic ash clouds. In 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted, spewing sulfate particles into the atmosphere that caused global temperatures to drop 0.6 degrees Celsius over the next 2 years. Solar radiation management would involve sending fleets of aeroplanes up into the air to 65,000 feet, where they'd spray sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere, or perhaps even spray diamond dust. A research team at Harvard University projects that if high-altitude tankers had the capacity to make 60,000 particle dumps by 2035, it would shave off 0.3 degrees Celsius of global warming. But what else is being explored? Another idea is to pump salt water from the oceans into the air, forming water droplets that would make marine clouds brighter and thus more reflective. Australia is funding research hoping enhanced clouds could cool water temperatures enough to save the already damaged Great Barrier Reef. Researchers at Cambridge University in Britain are studying whether ships can pump salt particles into low-lying polar clouds to help refreeze polar ice caps. Other researchers wonder whether seeding oceans with iron could stimulate the growth of marine algae, which soaks up carbon dioxide from the air. For now, solar radiation management is thought to be scientifically the sturdiest candidate. Dr. Douglas McMartin at Cornell University engineer says, "We know with 100% certainty that we can cool the planet." So why not do it now? Well, meddling with Mother Nature is risky. Earth's weather systems are interconnected in extremely complex ways, which is why climate change is believed to impact everything from how long hurricanes linger over coastlines to how fast wildfires accelerate. Tinkering with one aspect of weather could have dangerous unforeseen ripple effects. 2 years ago, Nature magazine called geoengineering outlandish and unsettling. For example, could blocking sunlight impact the Asian monsoon season, which 2 billion people depend on for food crops, or alter the ocean's acidity? For geoengineering to be politically feasible, scientists would have to convince ordinary people that it's worth the calculated risk. Last year, Harvard University sought to send a balloon into the stratosphere over Tucson, Arizona, in order to release small amounts of calcium carbonate or chalk to test whether the reflective particles could block some sunlight, but public outcry forced the experiment to be postponed. But is safety the only concern? Well, no. Some climate activists argue that geoengineering serves as a get-out-of-jail-free panacea that would allow carbon-emitting corporations to conduct business as usual. They argue that no technological breakthroughs would eliminate the long-term need to abandon fossil fuels. Raymond Pierre-Humbert, a Nobel Prize-winning professor at Oxford University, compares relying on geoengineering without cutting carbon dioxide emissions to jumping off the Washington Monument and hoping somebody invests anti-gravity before you hit the ground. Where do most scientists stand on this? Well, the global failure to make major emission cuts is causing many experts to reconsider geoengineering. Compared with the massive financial consequences of global warming, the estimated $2 billion annual price tag to develop solar engineering over the next 15 years is quite inexpensive. In March, the Australian team conducted one of the world's first geoengineering trials, using 100 nozzles to enhance existing clouds by blasting salt water into the air. In theory, it would take about 1,000 nozzles to save the entire Great Barrier Reef from dying off. Harvard University professor David Keith says, "People are right to fear over-reliance on techno-fixes," he added, "but there's another nightmare. We realize in hindsight that early use of geoengineering could have saved millions of lives lost in heat waves and helped preserve some of the natural world." How about sucking carbon out of the air? The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said, "The world must remove 1 trillion tons of carbon by 2100. Or have any hope of avoiding more than 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. A proposed solution, carbon capture, takes 2 forms. Removing carbon dioxide directly from the emissions of power plants and other industrial facilities, or scrubbing it from the atmosphere. At least 19 large-scale projects worldwide are working to capture carbon dioxide from smokestacks at coal or natural gas power plants. Such a system was created in 2017 at a Texas coal plant but shut down this May because it captured just 17% of carbon dioxide emissions, not the target of 33%. The more ambitious plan for carbon capture involves installing pipes to suck carbon from the sky, then store it deep underground. Several companies have developed technology to do just that, but the process remains more expensive. Stripe, a startup company, enables companies and individuals to contribute money to fund carbon dioxide removal as a means of getting the technology off the ground. Nan Ransohoff, the head of Stripe Climate, told The Atlantic magazine, "This is a hardware problem. It's an infrastructure problem. It's a science problem." Ransohoff added, "It takes a long time to develop carbon removal. This is not Snapchat."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing our discussion on the hadith of Hisham ibn Hakam, which he narrates from Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, we have reached the 14th section of this tradition. Here, in this section, the Imam alayhi salam explains to Hisham the only purpose, according to this tradition, why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent prophets and messengers, the Anbiya and the Rusul. So the Imam says, "Oh Hisham, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has only sent the prophets and messengers to his servants so that his servants should know him as he has described himself." So this is very important, that the prophets and the messengers, now there is a difference between prophets and messengers. We don't want to get into that discussion right now. There is a clear difference. Brothers and sisters may refer to certain books of theology. For example, the book of Ayatollah Miss Bayazdi, that in English is known as the Theological Instructions. In there, certain differences between prophets and messengers have been mentioned. It's in English as well. Obviously, if there are certain things in the book that you require a teacher, please go to a teacher and a scholar to explain to you certain important points. But here, the Imam is mentioned both, but there is a difference between the Anbiya and the Rasul, the prophets and the messengers. So the Imam then says, "Oh Hisham, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has only sent his prophets and messengers to his servants so that his servants should know him as he has described himself." So the prophets just come and tell people, this is how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has described himself, and they don't add or subtract anything from their own. Thus, those of them who answered the call of the prophets and messengers best, these are the servants, those are people who have heard the call of the prophets and messengers, those who have submitted to that call, and those who know the call the best, know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and matters related to him the best. And those of them who know about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's matters related to Allah the best employ their intellects in the best manner. And those who employ and use the intellects in the best manner are those who are at the highest station in this world and in the hereafter. So here we see a hierarchy, a certain system that is in place. That the prophets came with a message. The best of those people who understood the message are those who submitted to that message. Not only did they submit blindly, but they understood the matters that are related to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that were brought by the prophets, by the messengers. They understood it with their intellects, and then they acted upon it also. They did not say, "Okay, I agree with this person, it's 100%. But they acted upon it, and therefore they earned a high rank and station in this world, and an even higher one in the hereafter. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us of such individuals, inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
The debate.
The United Nations says Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine seen in decades due to years of war. UN humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock said